Greetings, and we now continue in the next installment on our series on Megillat Esther. In the last shiur, we ended off by looking at the first two verses of chapter 3, the first two psukim of Perek Gimel, in which the meteoric rise of Haman is presented, and the command that certain people, contrary to conventional understanding of the Megillah, it is only the members of the court who have to bow down to Haman, prostrate themselves before Haman, and that only in the palace gates, meaning in their offices. And Mordechai's refusal to bow down, and the last year we discussed some of the problems with Mordechai's refusal, how central it is to the plot, how the different approaches that that Chazal took to understanding why he didn't bow down, and some of the difficulties in those approaches. Tonight, in this installment, we're going to complete the study through Pasuk Zayin, through verse 7, which is the first half of the chapter. It's just about exactly a half of the chapter, and it is the logical middle besides the graphic middle. I'll explain that right away. In the text of the Tanakh, there are no breakdowns in a chapter. Chapter division is a very late intrusion into the text, and often it's an intrusion that really violates the sense of the text. Such is the case in a couple cases in Megillat Esther also. However, there is an inherent breakdown in the text into paragraphs or parashot. And the chapter 3 is broken up into two parashot. The first parashah starts at Pasuk Aleph at verse 1, and it ends after Pasuk Zion. The next parashah begins at Pasuk Chet at verse 8 and goes to the conclusion of the chapter. And the division is very clear because the first seven verses lay out the beginning of the interaction between Haman and Mordechai, the animosity, and what happens inside Haman's head, and as he acts outside of the purview of the king. The rest of the chapter is the interaction between Haman and the king, which we will have to look at with painstaking detail to really understand what's going on, and the king's imprimatur given on the documents that go out. So rightfully, we would title the first section of chapter 3 Haman and Mordechai, and we would title the second section Haman and Achashverosh. In any case, after completing our study, at least through the first parashah, through Pasuk Zion, we will then look back and see if we can come up with another explanation of why Mordechai refused to bow down, one that will assuage the concerns raised in against the other explanations. In Pasuk Gimel, Vayimrov de'amelech eshvashar melech leMordechai. Now, one thing to note here is that Haman is not aware of Mordechai's refusal to bow down or Mordechai's omission, because he notices nothing. It is the other members of the court, and they are critical in this story, far more critical than people imagine. And it is they who notice this, and they start pestering Mordechai. Why are they pestering Mordechai? Well, we'll suggest an interesting theory in that regard also. So, it is the members of the court who are at the palace gates. In other words, the people who are in situ, who are right now affected by the decree and should be bowing down. Interesting that they do not say to Mordechai, why are you not bowing down to Haman? Why are you not showing honor to the king's favored minister? But rather, why are you violating the command of the king? And that really cuts to the nut of what's going on, and it is an important subtext throughout the Megillah, this issue of violating or being true to the orders of the king. This is a deeper subtext that's going to come out as to who the real loyal subjects of the king are, and we will be quite surprised as we begin that course right now and end up finding out in Perek Vav and Perek Zayin, chapter 6 and 7, who the real loyalist is, are. In any case, the text goes on and uses a phrase that is a very critical phrase to remember. Vayhi ke'omram elav yom vayom, as the other members of the court spoke to Mordechai day after day. In other words, this went on for a number of days, and the other members of the court continue to pester Mordechai. Why aren't you bowing down? And what did he do? Velo shama alehem. He didn't heed them. Doesn't mean he heard them. He heard them, but he didn't heed them. He didn't bend to their wishes, and he didn't bend to Haman either. Now, this seems to be going on ad infinitum. They just continue to pester Mordechai. Mordechai refused to bow down day after day, and then something changes. What changes? Vayagidu l'Haman. Then they went and told Haman. What did they tell Haman? That Mordechai is not bowing down. And again, that means Haman doesn't see him. So we would have to posit that Haman was being carried through the palace gates in some sort of a sedan with a curtain around it. He wasn't really able to see who was bowing down, which of course is very problematic because, as we discover through the story of Haman, that which drives him is really his ego, and it's hard to believe that he would gain much satisfaction from some vague awareness of people bowing down without being able to see them. But in some way or another, Haman is not aware of Mordechai is not bowing down until the servants come and tell him, the other members of the court tell him. Now, why did they tell him? Lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai. They wanted to see if Mordechai's words would stand, and there was a definite play on words here, because it's Mordechai who insists on standing, and it is Haman who insists that he bow. So the question is, will he stand or will he fall? Meaning, will he cave in, or will he be able to stand up to Haman? Ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Here's the kicker. What suddenly set them off to go running to Haman and say, Mordechai's not bowing down? Because Mordechai told them he's a Yehudi. Now, that line alone is worth an entire shiur. We won't spend an entire shiur on it, but we have to take a look at it. Mordechai tells them he's a Yehudi. Remember, this is Mordechai who has been working in the court and who has been present in the palace gates for over 6 years, because we're going to find out fairly soon that these events take place in the 12th year of Ahasuerus. Remember that Esther was crowned in the 7th year of Ahasuerus, and Esther spent a full year in the palace before she was crowned. The year that every girl gets is preparation, which means, and Mordechai, from the day that she was there, was at the palace gates, keeping an eye on Esther, and of course, as we mentioned a couple of shiurim ago, there's only one way that he could do that, which is that he's a member of the court. Which means he is a member of the court, he's in the palace gates, day in, day out, for at least 6 years, if not longer, and nobody knows he's Jewish. His co-workers don't know he's Jewish. That's something to think about. Suddenly, he opens his mouth and says something about him being Jewish, and it has something to do with his refusal to bow down. That, of course, leads to the most reasonable explanation of his refusal to bow down, that there is some religious dictate that prevents him from bowing down, either because Haman is associated with idolatry, some of the explanations that I shared last year. Of course, every one of them has a difficulty with it, which means we have to identify somewhere in his words, he's a Yehudi, a proper explanation for why he refused to bow down, which skirts those problems or solves or is not beset by those problems. We'll see. Question is, why did that set them off to go to Haman? And I think there's three possible explanations, and one of them is more recommended by the text. The first explanation is that, a simple one, is that these members of the court are looking for a good fight. They want some entertainment. Much as happens often on schoolyards when two people push each other and suddenly there's a circle of students around them before the shop teacher comes and breaks it up or the gym coach yelling, fight, 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 fight. And the people know that Haman has animus towards Jews. The minute they find out Mordechai is a Jew, they say, oh, we got a good fight here. Let's tell Haman that Mordechai is not bowing down and let's see what happens. That's very tempting to say that, but it also doesn't fit the text very well. Because what does the text say? They went to tell Haman, Lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai, to see whether or not Mordechai would be able to stand up to Haman. That doesn't indicate that they're looking for a good fight, but rather to see whether Mordechai will be able to withstand Haman. It's a little bit of a different tenor, which leads us to a second possibility. Second possibility is that the real anti-Semites is a real anachronism here. So the real Jew haters in the court is not Haman, but rather the other members of the court. And they didn't know Mordechai was Jewish. Mordechai refused to bow down. At some point in the discussion, he owns up to the fact that he's Jewish. And now they say, oh, let's get the Jew. And so they say, let's go get him in trouble. We'll go tell Haman on him. And then Haman will take him down. So in other words, they are the ones who hate Jews. And because Mordechai tells them he's Jewish, therefore they go off and get him in trouble. But I think that that's also not necessarily the best way to see it. Besides which, if Mordechai knew that they hated Jews, either he would openly be a Jew from the very beginning and they would know he was Jewish, or at this critical juncture, and Mordechai does not seem to be a foolish person at all, he wouldn't open his mouth and say he's Jewish. Why get himself in further trouble? So I think that there's a third suggestion which is most recommended by the text. And that is as follows. go back to the beginning of Perek Gimel. Haman has this meteoric rise out of nowhere. We haven't heard of him before this, and we know that the king has trusted members of the court who are his close members, his sarisim, his roi pe amelech, the ones who see his face, etc. He's got a government, he's got a cabinet, he's got advisors. This Haman seems to come out of nowhere. As I mentioned in the last shiur, Chazal say Haman is memuchan because if you really want to understand how Haman works, look at the psychological manipulation that Memuchan, in the middle of the first chapter, evinces and utilizes, and is utilized in order to get Ahasuerus to do what he wants. So Haman evidently comes fairly out of nowhere, and suddenly gets the king to agree to something, evidently, and evidently is critical here, evidently gets the king to agree to something which is really quite strange, which is to elevate one minister above the rest of his ministers. You might call that political suicide, especially for a king who has a tentative hold on his rule and is sure to sow the seeds of discord among the other ministers upon whose loyalty he really relies and depends. And if I were one of the ministers, I certainly would feel a lot of resentment towards this Johnny-come-lately to whom I have to suddenly show obeisance. It's very, very distressing. So now here's what happens. All the other members of the court cave in. They don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the intestinal fortitude to stand up to Haman. So they bow. They see there's one guy not bowing. Now, why is this guy not bowing? So, several possibilities. They don't know. Several possibilities. One possibility is he doesn't like Haman. The other possibility is, I'm saying this half-jokingly, he has a bad back. The other possibility is that he's not long for the job, and why bother himself? For whatever reasons. So, if his reasons are utilitarian or personal or issues of convenience, so then you would say, okay, good. So he's not bowing down. And if we tell Haman that he's not bowing down, then Haman will simply punish him or overlook it or whatever will happen. But what the ministers of the court really want to do is they want to take Haman down. When they find out that this guy's reason is not personal or convenience, but it's rooted in ideology and religion, it has something to do with faith, then they know he's going to really stand his ground. Now they say, here's a guy who maybe could take Haman down. And so what do? They set up the confrontation between Haman and Mordechai, not to get Mordechai in trouble, but rather to see if maybe they can get Haman taken down. And that's why the words say, lir'ot hayamdu divrei Mordechai. In other words, will Mordechai's words stand up, and will he be able to remain standing, and therefore that would mean that Haman would be taken down. And then they would feel a certain amount of relief. And by the way, that's exactly how things play out. So that's another possible suggestion. We still haven't gotten to the real nut, which is why Mordechai didn't bow down. We'll get to that after we finish through Perek Zayin, Pasuk Zayin. Now, Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai koreot mishtachavelo. Haman saw that Mordechai now took notice. He saw that Mordechai was not koreot. By the way, koreot, at least the Chachamim explained, koreot doesn't mean to just bow your head. It means to kneel on the ground, to put your head on the ground. Mishtachave is really to prostrate yourself totally all fours on the ground. So he saw that Mordechai was not showing the proper obeisance. Vayimaleh Haman chema. Haman was immediately filled with anger. Now, this is one trait, and perhaps the only trait, shared by Haman and Ahasuerus, is a quickness to anger. And in the case of Ahasuerus, she also was able to be mollified. We don't find that very much in Haman's case, although perhaps at one point. But Haman becomes filled with anger. Now, if you think about it, there's something we'll get back to in Parakeh. But if you think about it, there's something very pathetic about this. Here's a guy who, until recently, was not heard of. He has a meteoric rise in the court of the emperor who controls the known world. We're not talking about a city councilman in Podunk, Iowa. We're talking here about the closest advisor to the emperor of Russia, of Persia. So the Persian Empire controls the entire world. And this guy has not only the ear of the king and the power behind the empire, but he's got all his colleagues bowing to him. And one guy in the court isn't bowing down to him, and he blows up. Now, this gets far worse in Parakeh, but at this point it shows to something very fragile about Haman that we will discuss again in the introduction to Parakeh, which will be really an introduction to Psych 101. In any case, Haman is filled with anger. And now, what does Haman do? Vayivez be'inav lishloach yad v'Mordechai levado. So it was beneath him to just kill Mordechai. Killing Mordechai, that's not good enough. Why? Ki gidu lo at am Mordechai. And we have to read this very carefully, because the midrashic development of Haman is, of course, as a descendant of Amalek and as a Jew hater from birth and as somebody who lives to eradicate the Jewish people. But we have to read the text very carefully. The text itself says as follows, that it was beneath him to just kill Mordechai because they told him who Mordechai's nation was. Who is Mordechai's nation? So what does he do? Vayvakesh Haman lahashmid et kol ha'yudim. So Haman sought a way to destroy all of the Jews, asher b'chol malchut Achashverosh, that are throughout Achashverosh's kingdom, which is really overkill, sorry for the pun, but it is really overkill. Because it's not as if, okay, I'm going to take Mordechai down, I'll take his family down, I'll take his neighbors down, I'll take all of his neighbors, I'll take any of his known associates. But rather, I found out he's a Jew, I'm going to kill all the Jews. But notice what the text says at the very end to clarify. Vayvakesh Haman lashmid et kol ha'yudim asher b'chol malchut Achashverosh am Mordechai. In other words, why does he want to kill the Jews? I know that this sounds very unconventional, but this is what the text says. Because they are am Mordechai. In other words, if Mordechai was a Chechen, he'd want to kill all the Chechens. If Mordechai is an Armenian, he'd want to kill all the Armenians. Mordechai's a Jew, good, I'll kill all the Jews. In other words, his animus is personal towards Mordechai, and by extension to Mordechai's people, it does not start as animus towards Jews. This is certainly at least one way to read the text, and I believe a very straight way to read the text. Now, what does Haman do? Haman now decides he's going to kill the Jews. But Haman is as much of a slave to the superstitions of his religion as any other member of his religion. So, b'chodesh harishon, hu chodesh nisan, we'll talk about this in a minute, in the first month, b'shnat shtein esrei lemelech Achashverosh, I mentioned this in the 12th year of Achashverosh. Now, it makes it sound, and this is, we're going to find out in a minute, this happened on the 13th of Nisan, it makes it sound as if all of these events have happened very quickly. That Haman has his meteoric rise, and then there's an edict that the people bow down, and within several days he discovers that Mordechai hasn't bowed down, so it makes it sound as if Haman has not been in this high position in government for more than a couple of weeks. We will not get any better information than that, but that is the impression you get. So what did he do in this month? He peeled pur hu ha-goral. That's the second time in the pasuk that there has been a self-identification. We'll talk about it in a moment. Lifnei Haman, miyom liyom michodesh lechodesh ne'masar uchodesh adar. Evidently this lottery, however it worked, had two components to it. One was day of the month, the other was which month. And so he had a lottery, but it says he peeled pur lifnei Haman. In other words, somebody threw down the pur in the presence of Haman. Who was the somebody? We'd have to posit that it's a wizard or a sorcerer of some sort who throws down this lottery, and the lottery comes out from month to month to the month of Adar. Now, it doesn't say which day in Adar here. We're going to find out later on that the day in Adar is the 13th of Adar. That's the day slated as the most auspicious day to kill Jews. And so that's where Haman's going to work with. Now, we're going to find out later on in the text that Haman has a real problem with impulse control. And Haman has a real difficulty putting off till tomorrow what he may be able to run and do today. And by the way, that's what really gets him in trouble. So you can imagine that for Haman, this is a grave disappointment to think that now we are in the month of Nisan, and he's going to have to wait 11 months until he's going to be able to kill the Jews and see the death of his enemies. That's going to be very hard for him. So the question is, so why doesn't Haman do a do-over? Why doesn't he have a second lottery? The answer is, that's what the stars said. That's what he's stuck with. And he doesn't have a chance to do a do-over. Now, from the fact that the lottery was took place on the 13th of Nisan, and then it was on the 13th of Adar that they were slated, there's the possibility that the lottery only had one component, which is months. And whatever month it'll be the same day of the month as the lottery is thrown, and that month will be the day that's auspicious for the event. So it's possible that the lottery only included months. But the text says, miyom liyom, michodesh lechodesh, makes it sound like there were two components, days and months. Now, I mentioned back in the middle of Perek Bet, when Esther was taken in the 10th month, and the text identified, b'chodesh ha'siri u'chodesh tevet, that the reason the text does that is because the number months, Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh HaSiri, etc., is the biblical manner of identifying months, because all months start with the month of the spring, which is the month of the Exodus. And in the meantime, during Second Temple times, the Jews had already integrated and adopted the Babylonian month names, which are pagan names, Nisan and Tevet and Sivan, etc. And therefore, in Esther, and also we find it in Ezra and Nehemiah and several of the other Bayit Sheni books, Second Temple books, there is a utilization of those pagan names, which then become fully into Jewish use by the rabbinic period. And therefore, the text identifies this both to the Jewish audience, B'chodesh HaRishon, and also to the Persian audience, as it were, Hu Chodesh Nisan. Now, the text also identifies Pur Hu HaGoral. Why is that? Because the text has to refer to the lottery as a Pur, because the holiday the Jews have been celebrating since before the Megillah was completed is a holiday that they call Purim. And there's no way I would understand what the holiday is if I don't know that at this point, where everything started, Haman had a Pur, a lottery. But on the other hand, the Jewish reader doesn't know what a Pur is. It's a Persian word. And so therefore the text translates, HaPur Hu HaGoral. And then, therefore I understand what's happening. Now, we finished through Pasuk Zion. I would like to now suggest, taking a look back, another explanation, another answer to Mordechai's refusal to bow down that explains his behavior both in light of the challenges that I raised last time about whatever his reasons may be, they don't justify endangering all of Am Yisrael. Besides which, the reasons themselves are somewhat questionable. And the way to do that is a piece of methodology that I introduced in the beginning of the series, and it's a methodology that you always have to keep in mind whenever studying any book of Tanakh, and certainly late books of Tanakh. And that is that every biblical author writing Beruach HaKodesh, writing by divine inspiration, is aware that his audience, his central audience, is fully familiar in the original with earlier books of Tanakh. Everybody reading Sefer Yehoshua, during the time of Yehoshua, knows Sefer Bereshit. Certainly everybody studying Yirmiyahu is familiar with Amos. And as a result of that, later books will borrow phrases from earlier books, midrashically, meaning that they will use a phrase and then use it in a way that comments either on the earlier passage or on the contemporary passage. And we saw that in spades at the beginning of Megillat Esther, in the description of Ahasuerus' party, which utilizes all sorts of terms that are used to describe the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the essential story of Megillat Esther is a story which fits into a genre referred to as the Jew in the foreign court. It's a genre that is chiefly a Second Temple genre. We have it with Mordechai, we have it with Nehemiah, we have it with Daniel. But of course, the first Jew in the foreign court goes all the way back to the book of Bereshit, and that is Yosef in Pharaoh's court. In a sense, the story of Yosef in Pharaoh's court becomes the urtext, sort of the archtext for the Jew in the foreign court. And notice how many parallels there are. Many have commented on this, on the many parallels between Yosef in Pharaoh's court and Mordechai in Pharaoh's court and the entire story of Megillat Esther. There is the motif of Mishneh LaMelech. There is the motif, me being the second to the king, and that exact wording used. There is the motif of the handing over the signet ring, which Pharaoh does to Yosef, and which famously Ahasuerus does first to Haman, and then later to Mordechai. And there are a number of motifs. Chazal pick up on this at the very end of the first chapter of Masachat Megillah, when they weave together Yosef's treatment of Binyamin, his beloved brother, at the feast before Yosef revealed his identity. And he associates that with the events of Mordechai, the descent of Binyamin, in the presence of Ahasuerus, the garments, etc. So there's much to be said for that. Now, within this context of the Yosef story, there is a very near parallel, and it's one that John Levinson points out in his commentary on Esther, a wonderful book, a parallel to the stand of Mordechai at the palace gates. Mordechai is standing at the palace gates, and the members of the court are pestering him to bow down to Haman. The phrasing used, and I mentioned, you should keep this in mind, the phrasing used in the beginning of Pasuk Dalet is Vayhi ki Omram Elav Yom Vayom Velo Shama Alehem. They pestered him every day, and he did not heed them. This reminds us exactly of the scenario between Yosef and his master's wife Eshet Potiphar, Mrs. Potiphar, who tries day after day to seduce him in Bereshit Lamed Tet, in chapter 39 of Bereshit. She casts her eyes towards Yosef, and she says to him, sleep with me, and he refuses. Now listen very carefully to what plays out. Vayomer el Eshet Adonav, he says to his master's wife, this is in Perek Lamed Tet, Pasuk Chet, 39:8. Hein Adoni lo yada iti ma bavayit. My master knows nothing of what's with me in the house, meaning he has entrusted everything in the house to me. V'chol asher yishlo natan biyadi, he's given me everything. In other words, I have full control over the house. Einenu gadol bavayit hazemeni, he is no greater in the house than me. The master of the house is no greater than me, his steward. V'lo chasach mimeni me'umah, he's kept nothing from me. I have access to everything. Ki im otach basharat ishto, except for you, because you're his wife. How could I do this terrible evil? V'chatati l'Elohim. Chatati l'Elohim, speaking to an Egyptian woman, it would mean I would violate a moral sin. It would be a moral sin, a sin against God, to do this. But what is the sin here? The sin, more than anything else, seems to be a betrayal of the trust of my master by acting in this way, by sleeping with my master's wife. Now notice what she says, Vayhi kedabrai el Yosef yom yom, and she spoke to him day after day, v'lo shama eleha lishkav etzal liyotima, he did not heed her to lie with her and to be with her. Now the parallels between these two are just too close, and so I would like to pick up where Levinson left off and make the following suggestion, that if we identify the triangle that exists in Potiphar's house, which is Potiphar, Eshet Potiphar, and Yosef, and morph that on to the players here, we would have to have it be Mordechai and a combination of the Avdei HaMelech and Haman playing the role of Mrs. Potiphar and Achashverosh. Now, the reason that I have the other members of the court and Haman morphed together is because in the Potiphar story, it is the woman who wants the attention from Yosef, who is also doing the pestering. Whereas in our story, it's Haman who wants the honor, and it's the courtiers who are doing the pestering. So it becomes split into two different personalities or groups in the Esther story. Now, why is it that Yosef refuses to sleep with Mrs. Potiphar? The simplest read of the text is, it's a betrayal of the trust given to him by his master. It would be an act of treason and sedition, as it were, against his master, to take advantage of this situation. Now, if we read that as a parallel, then what's happening here? Mordechai is turning around and he is saying, I refuse to bow down to Haman because that is a treacherous act towards the king. Step back for a second and think about it. To bow down to any member of the court in a way that is only befitting the king is an act of sedition. It's showing royal honor to someone who's not the king. And that is a betrayal of trust of Achashverosh. Now, what Mordechai is really claiming here is that Haman never got the go-ahead. In other words, that the people aren't really commanded by Achashverosh to bow down. In other words, that Haman came out and said, Achashverosh wants you all to bow down to me, and nobody had the guts to stand up to him and say, we don't believe you. They were too afraid of Haman, he was too powerful, and Achashverosh, and this you can see in the text, was far too removed from what was going on, especially outside of his own court, meaning outside in the palace gates and beyond. He was quite unaware of what's going on. It becomes very clear when the plot to kill his own queen is revealed to him, and he's astounded. He has no idea what's going on outside. And so therefore, it's very easy for Haman, who has all of this power, to come into the gates where the king never gets to. It says, the king said, you got to bow down to me. And take a look very carefully at the words and you'll see it. In Pasuk Bet, it says, they all bow down to him. Now there's two ways to translate that. For the king commanded concerning him, or the king commanded him. In other words, Haman comes out and says, the king told me that you all have to do this. And so to stand up to Haman would mean, I'm calling you a liar, and I don't believe you. And so Mordechai's refusal to bow down is not based on inconvenience, it's not based on other considerations, it's based on his absolute loyalty to the king And he says, I am loyal to the king, and I will not bow down and show the kind of obeisance that only belongs to our king, Ahasuerus, to show it to this guy. How do we see that in the words? Because at what point do the courtiers come to Haman when Mordechai says, Asher hu Yehudi? These words are opaque. We have no idea what it means, Asher hu Yehudi. I like to suggest is he's saying, I, as a Jew, recognize that my loyalty is to the king. We are principled people. We recognize that the Persian government has been very good to us, etc., etc. Perhaps he said that, perhaps not. But as a Jew, I will not bow down to somebody who is not the king, because that is a traitorous act towards the king. And by the way, that's exactly how things play out. In the meantime, Haman is shown to be a traitor to the king, somebody who is taking the king's ring and signing all sorts of things the king doesn't know about, and writing edicts in the king's name, and ultimately plotting to kill the queen. In the meantime, Mordechai turns out to be the only loyal guy around. Because think about it, a few nights later, when Ahasuerus can't sleep, he opens up his book and he finds the one guy out there who was loyal to him is Mordechai. So Mordechai is proven by the events and by how things play out to be the one loyal member of the court, where Haman, who plays the role of trusted advisor temporarily, is proven in the end really to be a traitor. And indeed, that is, I believe, why Mordechai refuses to bow down and continues to refuse to bow down and is justified in the end. Because in the end, when everything becomes revealed, he really is shown to be the most loyal member of the court. Good. Mirtz Hashem, in the next year, which will be before Shabbat, we will do the second half of Perek Gimel and find some very, very astounding things in there as well. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbat and enjoy studying.